The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Shares of First Republic losing about half of their value just in yesterday's session, hitting an all-time low. The company reporting a massive drop in deposits, much more than the street had been expecting. And First Republic is going to other banks and saying, help us or else.
The pitch to these institutions, and these are the institutions that have already put in $30 billion in deposits into First Republic to prop it up last month, is that essentially, if you don't do this, this thing is going to go under. And if it does, the FDIC receivership costs that are going to be assessed on the big banks predominantly will actually be far greater, will be in the ballpark of $30 billion. So help us now or pay more later.
The sudden collapse of Silicon Valley Bank in March led to the government's swift and speedy action to prevent a disastrous contagion, all while First Republic Bank is reportedly most likely headed for Federal Deposit Insurance Corp receivership.
A lot of our viewers, maybe the doctor, you know, some doctor in Dallas or somebody watching in Des Moines, they think, well, I've never heard of First Republic. Maybe why do I care? And I think they should care because with all these regional banking problems, hard to see how credit doesn't tighten. It's harder to get a car loan, harder and more expensive to get a mortgage, and that is a macroeconomic story.
This is a rolling crisis, and the Fed, as they've hiked rates up higher and higher, they're draining the banking system. Okay, so the regional banks, the banks around the U.S. have lost $1 trillion, right, so far, and they're going to lose more because the Fed's threatening to even hike even more. So if you just look at it, from credit cards to all different types of companies, Capital One, credit default swaps are rising on many different financial institutions. And when you see that, be very careful with U.S. equities.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Well, the major indexes finished out the week with slight gains as better-than-expected earnings coming from Meta, Microsoft, and Amazon helped the Nasdaq finish out the week with slight gains. Meanwhile, more trouble ahead in the banking sector as a bank run of over $100 billion in First Republic makes it likely another Fed takeover or a merger could be in the works this weekend. The stock has lost 97% of its value this year. Meanwhile, on the inflation front, strong wage gains during the first quarter all but assures another quarter-point rate hike from the Fed next week. Overseas, Europe's economy is close to recession as central banks around the world hike interest rates in an effort to combat inflation. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplavin. Welcome to the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up, our technician this week is Ron Williams from RW Advisors. Ron sees opportunities for gold in the months ahead as central banks buy gold at the fastest pace in decades and more turbulence ahead for the markets. Up next is Robert Rapier as we look at the energy sector and opportunities ahead as both Exxon and Chevron reported blowout earnings in the first quarter. Finally, Chris Sheridan and I will discuss the looming debt crisis as the Treasury will be facing a major funding crisis with U.S. deficits exploding as spending runs wild in Congress. The fireworks could begin as soon as next month. But first, let's find out what's moved the markets this week with Ryan Poplava.
Hold on to your hats, folks, because the equity market was a wild ride this week. With earnings reports pouring in from some of the biggest companies in the world, we saw some major movements in the stock market. Question on everyone's mind, are we headed for a hard landing or a soft one? Was that answered this week? Depending on which company you listen to, the answer might be different. Tuesday, growth concerns drove the price action following First Republic Bank's disappointing earnings results that included a 40% decline in deposits. Barron's reported that a team of wealth advisors managing about $13 billion in assets said to be leaving the bank, and a Bloomberg report that First Republic is considering asset sales. All these items helped to drive a 4.2% loss in the regional banking ETF KRE. UPS's earnings report contributed to the slowdown worries after the company lowered fiscal year 23 revenue guidance due to macroeconomic conditions and changes in consumer behavior. On a related note, the April Consumer Confidence Index was weaker than expected at 101.3. Consensus for that was around 104, pressured by a drop in the expectations index. With losses in banks and downbeat guidance from UPS and a drop in consumer confidence, stocks didn't have a chance on Tuesday. Losses continued for the First Republic Bank into Wednesday, falling another 30% after stock was down around 40% the day before. Relatively disappointing guidance from the likes of Texas Instruments, down 2.9% on the day, Norfolk Southern, down 3%, in addition to a 0.4% decline in non-defense capital good orders in March, a proxy for business spending, piled onto the festering slowdown concerns from Tuesday. Thursday, everything turned around for U.S. stocks when Meta Platforms rose 13.9% after its earnings report by beating expectations, raising guidance with lower expense guidance for the year. Meta helped foster a sense of relief that the megacap leaders are still performing relatively well from an operational standpoint and maintaining their position as market leaders. Earnings-driven gains in Meta and Comcast, which was up 10.3% on the day, propelled the communication services sector to first place on the leaderboard by a huge margin. Economic results Thursday complemented the confidence restored in the mega caps by Meta, with a drop in the initial jobless claims of 16,000 down to 230,000. While elevated, jobless claims are still well below inflation averages during previous recessions. In addition, we received good news inside the lower read for the advanced first quarter GDP results. Although the initial impression of the real GDP increasing at only an annualized rate of 1.1% compared to 2.6 previously, that may not seem impressive, but a closer look at the report reveals an acceleration in personal consumption expenditure growth from 1% rose to 3.7%. The decline in overall figure can be attributed mainly to the decrease in private inventories, whereas real final sales of domestic product rose 3.4% when you exclude those inventories. Despite a drop in Amazon's earnings and concerns over slowing cloud services growth, along with continued losses in First Republic Bank, the stock market's rally that began on Thursday continued unabated on Friday. Even sharp losses in Pinterest and Snap's earnings had little effect on the market, except for maybe holding the NASDAQ back relative to its peers. The latest economic data showed a 0.3% month-over-month increase in personal income, while the PCE price index remained steady with year-over-year growth rate of around 4.6%, down slightly from 4.7% in February. These figures are strengthening the belief that the Fed will raise interest rates by a quarter point next week, followed by a likely pause. To recap, concerns over depositors shifting to higher yield savings options for regional banks, coupled with earnings-related setbacks in UPS, Texas Instruments, Norfolk Southern, contribute to a downtrend in stocks for the market up until Thursday. However, a rally triggered by Meta's earnings and positive economic data helped the market end on a high note. The upcoming week is expected to witness significant earnings announcements like this week, but the focus will be on the Federal Reserve's policy decision on Wednesday and its potential impact on the bond and equity markets. Up next, this week's guest technician, Ron William.
At a time, bank deposits offer very low interest and could be at risk. Corporate cash accounts are also progressively losing ground to inflation. At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we offer a solution to this problem. Our firm specializes in assisting companies by managing cash balances with short-term treasuries and high-quality corporate bonds that may provide higher interest rates. This approach not only helps to manage your corporate cash balances with competitive yields, but also to help reduce taxes through the use of treasury securities, which are exempt from state and local income taxes. Give us a call today at 888-486-3939 to find out how we can assist you to earn higher interest rates with no bank risk and no state and local income taxes. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Joining us on the program is Ron Williams from RW Advisors. Ron, let's begin with the top at the major indexes right now. Looks like a little turbulence is starting to develop. What's your take here?
Broad unwinding risk appetite is kickstarting again in line with our tactical market timing model. We cited this just recently with clients and across different platforms. Essentially, the S&P 500, as a case in point, is failing beneath the 4,200 price resistance, triggering a potential major reversal pattern. And what's interesting is from sentiment terms, the bulls are likely to be trapped based on options data with a lot of gamma play happening at that level. And there's a few other market internals like VIX ratios suggesting a mean reversion ahead, along with breadth measures and sector rotation that I can touch on.
Yeah, let's talk about secular rotation, because last year tech was hit pretty hard. As I look at some of the major indexes, we've got consumer staples are going up, consumer discretionary is going sideways. Energy looks like it's gone through a correction. Financials, God knows what's happening there. And then you have industrial stocks starting to break down. So let's go through some of the sectors. And what are you seeing in terms of rotation?
Well, it's been pretty narrow year to date. And what's interesting is, of course, the laggards of last year have become the leaders of this year. And so the new narrative has been selectivity and dispersion. So that's what's held the market. And of course, tech has been the leader. What's concerning, I mean, outside of the narrowness of the breadth and rotation, has been now that leadership starting to show price exhaustion. That's also on the back of inline expectations for earnings that just came out for some of the tech firms, but it is down quarter on quarter. So there's an interesting price and fundamental convergence there to the downside. And I think what's even more ominous and the echo event that we're all thinking about right here and now is, of course, the reignition of the banking crisis in terms of the regional banks and what just happened with First Republic and the index itself. If you look at the index, it's still sliding lower as we speak.
You know, the interesting thing about that, Ron, when Silicon Valley went under and Signature Bank, they thought the crisis was over. But to me, as I take a look at the fundamentals, one of the largest deposit withdrawals that we've seen in these banks, I don't think this thing's over yet.
Well, there's been some strong voices already speaking on this. And certainly, if you look at the CEO of BlackRock and also Ray Dalio from Bridgewater House, they all are cautious at this moment in time and have suggested that it's too early to call the end of this. For some time, I've been warning of a Minsky moment part X as part of a technical analysis pattern, particularly on the S&P 500 from a behavioral perspective, but also, of course, fueled with this cheap money mirage that has clearly come to an end from last year when we had the rate shock and inflation rise.
So I want to talk about another sector that it looks like it wants to break out, but you did a special piece on it. Let's talk about the gold market. Given the things that we're seeing in the geopolitical realm, on the financial realm, on inflation, gold has had several attempts to take out 2000. You have a chart of that, both in 2021, 2022, and then recently. Looks like it's struggling to get through there. What's your take on gold here?
So gold consolidation with a risk to a short-term correction, but a long-term target at $2,800, which is an inflation-adjusted mark. Right here and now, it's hitting that glass ceiling 2000 for the third time in the last few years. And each time it has failed, we're likely to take a step or two back before we actually clearly break above it. Across our ranking model, global cross asset, it's been strong, but has lost momentum in the short term. And that's partly what we're seeing gold in dollar terms. And it's important to preface that, of course, gold across other currencies has been broadly strong, and that's part of a fiat currency hedge. But what's interesting is gold in dollar terms has actually been the laggard. I think it's gold, dollar, gold, euro have been the weakest link of the basket. Right now, leading is gold, South African rand, and Japanese yen, and there are FX-specific volatility stories there. But generally speaking, it's the fiat debasement story. And if you look at some of the historical charts, most, if not all, currencies have devalued in a very big way against the gold. And that story will continue, of course, with the central bank debt around the world ballooning to new highs. And we have that debt ceiling event just around the corner, which the bond market is already signaling some concern about.
So as you look at this, let's talk about another metal, which is silver. What's your take there? It's the one metal over the last 40, 50 years that has never broken out or surpassed its highs going back to the 80s. You can see copper has gone up, gold has gone up, iron ore has gone up, all the base metals have gone up, but not silver. What's your take?
Well, from a technical perspective, it certainly is relative value within the precious metals complex and particularly with gold. And as you mentioned, It is much lower from its all-time high, let alone at the all-time highs, which is what we see in gold across other currencies. Having said that, it is high beta and has chopped around for some time, producing some false signals. So we are looking for some clear directionality on silver. It already has been showing that recently. And keeping an eye on the gold-silver ratio to reflect that further in time.
And let's talk about something also that is played into the inflation scenario. There's a lot of talk about where the price of oil will be going here. We think it's going to be higher towards the end of the year. What is the chart telling you on oil as you look at that chart?
Oil has been disappointing from a chart perspective. And certainly, I take your point in terms of the overall commodity story and how that feeds through to inflation long term. But right here and now, we're not seeing it if we're looking at the underlying West Texas or Brent crude contract, keeping in mind that we've had plenty of tail risk from last year's geopolitical tensions. And yet, from a historical basis, a lot of the momentum was already in. And now we had a short-term rally in last few months, which has fizzled out, and we're looking like we're rolling back down again. So directionality on oil is not clear, but certainly in the long term, we could see surprises to the upside. It just hasn't proven out yet.
So as you look at this, and I want to talk about the bond market. We saw long-term yields break out. We saw 10-year treasuries go over 4%. They've been pulling back now. But we still have T-bills close to 5%. Ron, for the first time in two decades, this is the first time I've ever seen yields like this. It's hard to believe January of 2022, the 10-year treasury was at less than 0.5%. Today, it's over 3.5%.
More than likely, we'll see rolling volatility in rates and inflation. And I think that's the main story, rate of change rather than the threshold level at 5 or 3%. And clearly, we've tested both. What's interesting right now is the yield inversion, screaming out late cycle with potential recessionary concerns ahead. And looking at that, it's the shorter end of the curve that I'm most concerned about when we look at the 10-year versus 3-month, but also further lower, the short-term bills looking at the 1 to 3 month, which has shot up just literally this month, suggesting that recessionary concerns are ahead, but also other tail risks like the debt ceiling, like a potential rate cut, which is now part of the expectations in the market. I think that they're looking for September onwards based on implied overnight rates.
So given the fact that, you know, there's a saying that the Fed keeps raising interest rates until something breaks, either in the market or the economy, we are seeing a few breaks here, especially in the banking system. Is there anything that you're seeing the charts that would tell you this might play out differently, or we have more storms ahead of us?
Well, according to my composite cycle work, surprises will likely be to the downside into next year. So there's a whole lot of cycle work that we do at RWA based on composite cycle work, but also market-specific cycles. It also ties in with the work of some pioneers in the field, like Samuel Benner, W.D. Gann, that have made a long-term forecast for this year and next as being those elevated volatile periods. The light at the end of the tunnel is thereafter. And if you look at bear markets in history, it's an average of 2 to 3 years repair and recovery period. And we haven't seen that, certainly during the COVID period. It was only in 2008 prior to that. So that's still yet to come. And that also will likely fit into a long-term inflation story, according to our work. If and when we do get the shakeout, then we can start to see that secular long-term shift in inflation push up with commodities to follow.
And speaking of commodities, we had a big run in commodities in the 00 decade. I mean, that was when gold went from 250 on its way to 2000. Silver actually touched briefly $50. And we saw commodities take off driven by the industrialization of China. Now, as you look at where we're at now, we're making that green transition, which takes a lot of raw materials. But we're seeing shortages in inventory levels of key commodities. Do you see another commodity cycle developing here?
Yes, as part of a super long-term cycle in commodities and supported by an inflationary trend to follow. But right here and now, we still have that downside risk across asset class to come. So we may get short-term deflation first before we get that that follow through on commodities and inflation. And certainly that's what the charts suggest for now. And what's interesting is, of course, that central banks are hedging that way with generational highs in gold purchases. Sovereign risk is also firing up gold prices. And for the first time in a long time, countries around the world are choosing gold over U.S. treasuries. So we're seeing a little bit of de-dollarization and diversification across the board as part of a general risk hedge.
So given what you see in the charts right now, what would you be doing in the short term? And is there anything that looks attractive to you right now that you would be positioning for a longer term investment?
So short term, certainly it'd be good to overlay active framework and perhaps trim back some of those profits or even sell if necessary, shift from overweight to neutral or underweight, add a little bit more cash, increase on gold. And for those that are open-minded to the crypto space, of course, they can maybe work on an 80-20 rule, 80% gold, 20% crypto as part of what is described as a bold mix of the two. Outside of that, wait and see, because the next few weeks and months, the cycles on our work is suggesting elevated volatility. So unless that's part of your strategy, it's better to wait through the storm so that we have enough powder to let the dust settle and then ultimately look for those renewed opportunities thereafter.
So you see a long-term cycle developing both in commodities and probably inflation, some short-term volatility, maybe some pullback. What about a barbell strategy where you would have some risk assets, but maybe on the other side, you're holding cash and T-bills?
That would be a strategic move and certainly what we've been advising clients of late.
All right. Well, listen, Ron, if our listeners would like to follow you, by the way, you have the most colorful newsletters I've ever seen. I mean, I love it. It makes it easy on the eyes. How could our listeners find out more?
Thank you very much. Picture speaks 1,000 words, and we like to keep it visual. So RW Advisory is our website portal space. And for social, feel free to follow us on LinkedIn and Twitter share any insights or feedback. We're happy to discuss market insights. And I look forward to following up as and when markets move.
All right. Well, listen, Ron, thanks so much for joining us on the program. Have yourself a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we are committed to helping you build, maintain, and preserve your wealth. Contact us today to find out about our comprehensive financial planning and asset management services. Whether you're planning for retirement, taxes, putting together an estate plan, or need assistance in managing a 401k, Financial Sense Wealth Management is here to help. Give us a call to speak with one of our certified financial planners or wealth advisors at 888-486-3939 or go to financialsense.com and hit where it says Contact Us. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, there are many views on oil. Oil prices have been ticking up lately. There are some views with OPEC cuts that we could be facing higher oil prices, while others say not so fast. With the economy slowing down, well, that means less demand for energy. Well, let's find out where this is heading. Joining us on the program is Robert Rapier. Robert, why don't we begin and just get your views on oil, where we stand today, and where you see oil prices heading here as we head into the summer driving months.
Okay, so if we step back to last year when Russia invaded Ukraine, oil prices soared, gasoline prices soared, and Biden responded by the largest release from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve that we've ever had. And this is not the way that Strategic Petroleum Reserve is supposed to be used. It's supposed to be used in case of emergency. And high oil and gas prices, while inconvenient, are not the kind of emergency that this was designed to be used for. The kind of emergency that was for was like when the Arab members of OPEC cut off their oil exports in 1973 and really upended the U.S. and the global economy. That's the kind of thing that's supposed to be used for. Arguably, you could say that it helped stem the growth of oil prices last year, but at a price. And that price is you have this big insurance policy and it's dwindling over time. And OPEC sat there and they waited until it was largely depleted. And then they said, hey, guess what? We're going to cut production. Now, what's the Biden administration to do? Well, they don't really have many tools at their disposal now. They've depleted that insurance policy. And so that puts OPEC right back in the driver's seat. And that's where things are right now. So the question is, are we headed into recession, or, you know, is the economy going to remain strong enough to keep oil prices strong? And if we do head into recession, we may not see a steep rise in oil prices, but OPEC right now is really in the driver's seat as far as being able to withhold oil production and control prices. And the Biden administration really has kind of handcuffed themselves on that.
So, I mean, you take a look at the Strategic Petroleum Reserve was accumulated when oil prices were obviously lower than where they are today. And so the administration says they don't have plans to refill it at any time, but we should be doing it, because what happens if there's another embargo, there's another war or something like that that cuts off oil supply? Because, Robert, I wonder if you would address, when shale production was increasing over the last decade, everybody was saying the U.S. was energy independent, which isn't true because we were still importing large amounts of oil into this country.
Right. I always tell people when they say, are we energy independent? I say, well, define energy independence. What do you mean by that? If you mean we produce enough energy to satisfy our needs, then you could say, yes, we became energy independent after a long decade of increasing shale oil and gas production. By that definition, we became energy independent in 2019 or so, and we remain so today. But if you mean we don't import any oil, then we've never been energy independent. Since, I mean, the 40s or 50s, we've been importing oil. So, you know, it just depends on how people define it. But the energy supplies are so interdependent, you know, we're not going to be truly energy independent from not having to import oil. We import oil, we export oil, we import finished products, we export finished products. So, you know, we'll never be energy independent from that perspective. But if you say, hey, we make enough energy to supply our needs, then you can say, yeah, we're energy independent. So if we do make enough energy to supply our needs, the question is, well, why are we importing oil? We import oil that's a better fit for our refineries, and we export oil that's not as good a fit for our refineries. And that's why we import and export oil.
So let's talk about where we're moving. We're talking about this green transition. So like in California, we shut down one nuclear power plant. We're talking about shutting down nat gas plants and replacing them with intermittent wind and solar, which I don't think works. But we have mandates coming out of the administration. We have mandates coming out of certain blue state governors like our own and in New York. And it's like magically, Robert, we're going to be done with fossil fuels in 10 years. I just don't see that happening.
Yeah, the transition certainly will not take place that quickly. And, you know, there's a lot of dysfunction here in shutting down nuclear plants. I mean, that's a carbon-free electricity right there. And absolutely, we shouldn't be phasing out nuclear plants. We should be building more nuclear plants. Shutting down natural gas plants, I mean, the thing about wind and solar, they are intermittent. And so when production fluctuates, you need to be able to fill in the gap with something that's fast-acting. And gas plants can react quickly. So gas plants, as you do build out wind and solar, you really do need to have a good fast-acting backup. And gas plants serve as that fast-acting backup. So, you know, we're not going to be running the country on wind and solar in a decade. And if we're shutting down nuclear plants and shutting down gas plants in anticipation for that, we're setting up an energy crunch and soaring prices down the road, which we've done again and again. You know, we look forward and we say, hey, let's cut off supplies. So, you know, and they think, well, we've cut off supplies, then the renewables will fill the gap. And then we find out, well, okay, they're not here yet. And here's the future upon us. And now prices are soaring because we don't have enough.
And if you look at this, too, it's not that we don't have a stable power system to replace it. But if you take a look at whether it's transports by ship, by train, by truck, our economy runs on diesel fuel. Everything you buy at the grocery store, anything that gets delivered from Amazon, it comes by a truck or a van or something. I just don't see, you know, electrical vehicles replacing that in 10 years. And I don't know if we have a plan B, because we keep pushing forward with these mandates, not thinking this through.
Yeah. In fact, I've said that before lots of times. What is your plan B? What's your backup plan? You know, I often say that my energy policies are grounded in reality, not in what I wish things to be. I think it's okay to have legislation pushing things in a direction, but you better be prepared for a different future to arrive. And as you say, you know, if we said, hey, we're going to ban all internal combustion engines by, you know, 2035 or whatever, and you get to that point and the electric vehicles can't take the load that you anticipated, you better have a backup plan. So, you know, I've always said I like the all of the above energy strategy, but we can't be based on wishful thinking, and it has to be contingent. You know, you have to make sure that, you know, if this future doesn't arrive as we think it's going to, here we got backup plans. And I always said the Keystone Pipeline is a crystal clear, perfect example of this. If you built the Keystone Pipeline and the future got here and we didn't need that oil because we've transitioned to renewables faster than, you know, most people thought, what is the harm then in having built the Keystone Pipeline? There is no harm. It put money into the U.S. economy. It employed a lot of people. And so if the future got here and you didn't need it, then what happens? Well, you know, the company that built it, they take a loss and the investment didn't pay off. Now, think of the inverse. We get to the future and we're still highly dependent on oil. And instead of having a friendly supply of oil coming down from Canada, well, now we got to go get that from Venezuela. And we got to go get it from Saudi Arabia. And we got to get it from Russia. And we got to get it from places that, you know, whose interests don't necessarily align with ours. And that's the risk of having an energy policy that's sort of based on wishful thinking.
I want to talk about where we are now. We're about ready to head into the summer driving season. You and I were talking before we went on the air, and production is about ready to ramp up and could set a record this year. What does this mean for gasoline as we head into the summer driving season? Because already in California, we're well over $5 and could be heading to $6.
Right. So there are several things at play here. As you say, you know, we set up an oil production record in 2019, and then COVID hit. We probably would have set another one in 2020, but COVID hit and then took 3 million barrels a day off of production offline in 2020, and we've been gradually clawing that back. The annual production record in 2019 was 12.3 million barrels a day. We were producing 12.5 in January. So we're producing just above that level. If we hold that for the year, we could actually set a new production record this year. However, demand is also higher, and we are headed into summer driving season. And so this is another factor here. I just looked at gasoline inventories this morning. They are lower than normal right now. And usually when you see lower gas inventories, you see higher prices. And as we go into summer driving season, what happens is the transition is to a lower vapor pressure gasoline. And what that means is some of the more volatile components in gasoline, like butane makes up, you know, a significant amount of gasoline in winter where, you know, the temperatures are lower and it won't boil off. In the summer, the butane has to come to a very low level or it will boil off. And what that means is gasoline supplies in the summer are lower because you've taken butane now out of the gasoline pool, and prices are higher because butane is a relatively cheap component in gasoline. So every summer, we almost always see gasoline prices rise from January to May or so as transition to summer gasoline happens. And then you'll see them fall again in the fall as winter gasoline comes back on and you're putting the butane back in. And, you know, so supplies increase and the cost to produce that gasoline decreases. So we're probably looking at, you know, fairly high prices based on where inventories are right now. I'd say we're looking at pretty high prices this summer.
And could we set records like we did when we saw oil prices get over $100 a barrel? I know here in California, in fact, some places in Los Angeles, we got actually up to almost $8 gasoline. Could we see another spike like that, do you think?
I don't think we'll see it as bad as it was a year ago. A year ago, when we stopped importing Russian oil, so that really disrupted things because we really weren't importing Russian crude oil. We were importing a lot of Russian finished products and partially finished products that helped produce a lot of diesel. And when we said, hey, you know, because of your invasion, we're going to shut off those imports, that created a significant disruption at refineries. And suddenly there was a diesel shortage and refiners had to shift as much production as they could into diesel, which then affected the gasoline markets. And so what we saw a year ago was really a function of the disruption that happened as a result of Russia's invasion and our subsequent decision to stop importing Russian oil. Refineries have had a year now to kind of sort this out and get sourcing from other places. So I don't think it'll be as bad as it was a year ago, but, you know, I think we will continue to rise a little bit, you know, going on into the summer, particularly with inventories as low as they are right now.
So what would you be doing as an investor here? You know, one of the things that we've seen with the oil companies, they've been very disciplined on capital. The smaller companies have had difficult getting it because of ESG policies, but the big companies are buying back stock, they're increasing their dividends, and they've been very disciplined. Where would you be putting your money in the energy sector if you were investing right now?
Right. So, you know, with oil prices having pulled back as much as they have over the past year, and energy companies had a substantial pullback. You know, the energy sector was the number one performer for the last 2 years. And I felt like this year it was probably going to pull back based on, you know, oil prices having pulled back. I ran my energy stock screen this morning and a lot of names that I'm not as familiar with popped up for the first time. You know, I'm seeing very small tanker companies. I'm seeing small energy companies kind of populate, dominate that list. There are some mid-size MLPs in there. EnLink is popped up on my list. And then there's, you know, tanker companies, TK Tankers popped up pretty high on the list. Plains, GP Holding, the general partner for Plains, the Plains All-American MLP. And then if I go down another tier, I see Chevron on there. I see Holly Energy. So some refiners pop up, Marathon Petroleum. You know, and the Chevron is the only big oil company. And Chevron over the years has really been the outperformer over the past couple of decades. And, you know, they have pulled back significantly. You know, I did warn people when Chevron was up around $200 that I thought they could suffer a pretty significant drop as oil prices were falling, and they have pulled back a lot. So you might have some value in Chevron. Cenovus is on the list there, Suncor. But, you know, out of the whole, you know, population of energy companies, there just aren't a lot that are showing up really highly rated right now just because they haven't pulled back significantly with oil prices.
All right. Well, listen, Robert, if our listeners would like to follow you, tell them how they can easily do so. I think you write in several locations. I know you write for Forbes and a couple other, and I think you have your own newsletter. So tell our listeners about that.
Right. So I write 5 columns a month, typically for Forbes. So if you Google Robert Rapier Forbes, you'll find my columns there. My most recent column was on fourth generation nuclear power. I cover the whole energy sector there. And then for Investing Daily, I write several newsletters for Investing Daily. Every Tuesday, there'll be a free newsletter or a free column on Investing Daily's homepage. This week, I covered investment advice for a friend who's just starting to invest and kind of guided him through, you know, how to set up and what I would invest in. And I write Utility Forecaster and I write Income Accelerator, which is a covered call and cash covered put newsletter that, you know, consistently outperforms the S&P 500. At lower risk. And those are the newsletters that I write for Investing Daily.
All right. Well, listen, Robert, as always, thanks for joining us on the program.
Thanks for having me again.
Hi, I'm Jim Poplava. I started Financial Sense in 1985 to give clients a boutique personal investment experience that's hard to get at a large company. For 3 decades, my company has been helping families build, manage, and protect their wealth through tailored financial planning and investment management. If you are looking to make financial sense of a complex world, give our office a call at 888-486-3939 to speak with one of our advisors today and let us help you plan your future.
Welcome, everyone, to today's Big Picture. And we have highlighted over the last few months 3 emerging crises that are likely to buffet the U.S. economy the next few years. The first is the situation that we see with energy, which is putting us in a long-term precarious situation. U.S. debt and global debt levels as a whole, along with the very likely scenario of U.S. dollar devaluation given those debt levels. And over the last few weeks, we've highlighted the approaching energy crisis with a series of interviews, one of which was Marshall Adkins from Raymond James talking about the long-term outlook, as well as Robert Hirsch on his new book titled Energy, Modern Life, Climate Change, and Oil Production. Both of those interviews are definitely must-listen, so I would encourage you to go back and listen to those if you have not already. But today we're going to move on to the next approaching crisis, which is U.S. debt. And of course, we do have a looming debt ceiling debate coming up. It's probably not going to be pretty. So we're going to discuss this and how this relates to a U.S. dollar devaluation, and especially how you can prepare for these things so they don't take you by surprise.
U.S. debt now is roughly a little over $31.7 trillion. So by the time we get to summer, we're going to be at $32 trillion. And so people are saying, how did we get here? Well, if we take a look at the turn of the century, we've been involved in wars and entitlements. Take a look at the second Gulf War, the war on terrorism. We are now in a proxy war in the Ukraine. And then, of course, Social Security and Medicare, as 10,000 baby boomers retire every single day. So if we take a look at the year 2000, Bush comes in as president. He doubles the debt. He served two terms. President Obama comes in. He serves two terms. He doubles the debt. And then we got Trump and Biden, which are also going to double the debt. It's estimated that we could be at close to $40 trillion in debt by the time Biden's first term ends. A lot of this all came about, Chris, as we were adding all this debt, the Fed was able to keep interest rates low because most of the money printing that occurred, let's say, on the Fed's balance sheet stayed on the Fed. And if there was inflation, it occurred in the financial markets, not in the general economy. So we got this theory that came out. It was modern monetary theory that basically says, you know what? If you issue debt in your own currency, you can spend as much money as you want, issue as much debt as you want, because you can just simply print it. Well, that works until you get inflation. And what went wrong since 2020 is fiscally insanity. I mean, we added $10.5 trillion of debt in 3 years. Let me give you an example of this. In 2019, we had $22 trillion in debt. By 2020, it went to $23.2 trillion. In 2021, these were all these spending programs that came in with Biden's first year. We went from $23.2 trillion in 2020, we went to $21.8 trillion by the end of 2021. In 2022, we went to $30.4 trillion. And as we speak today, we're at $31.7 trillion. Now, I always try to put this in perspective, but this really encapsulates what we've done just in 3 years. It took 43 U.S. presidents in 250 years of U.S. history to accumulate $10.5 trillion of debt. We just did this in 3 years. Where is it coming from? Well, let me give you an example. Entitlements, that's Social Security, Medicare, disability, defense, and interest, used to make up about 65% of all tax revenues from the U.S. government. The other 35% went to running the government, everything from highways to government itself. Today, those three programs, entitlements, defense, and interest, equal 110% of tax revenues. Plus, if you take a look at the cost of running everything else the government does, at this point, Chris, as we have pointed out in a previous program, there simply is no way out of this. Debt is growing at 3 times faster than the economy. And just imagine what happens if we get into a recession. What happens to that debt is government tax revenues fall, which they're doing now. Last year, we had a surplus of tax revenues of $450 billion. That was the result of the big market gains in 2020 and 2021. This year, we have falling tax revenues, which raises the question, is the unemployment rate is really as low as they say it is, with falling tax revenues?
Yeah, and that was something that we discussed this week on FS Insider with a guest on how, I mean, there's really no way that you can solve this budget deficit or U.S. debt problem either by raising taxes or by cutting spending or by doing both. It's just so large, the math does not work out at this point, that the only way is to, I mean, essentially inflate our way out, which is what we've seen in the past.
Yeah, let's talk about a couple of those options, Chris. Paying down debt, simply at this point, it's too large. Are we really going to say to recipients of Social Security, hey, your $1,000 check, we're going to have to reduce it to $300. Are we really going to close down all 180 U.S. military bases and defund the military? You're just not going to see something like that happen. The second option of really defaulting on the debt, that's not going to happen because we can simply print the money to pay our debt. So the third way is inflate their way out. And that's going to involve three or four strategies. They're going to have to use what is called yield curve control. They're going to have to control interest rates. Because if we went back to, let's say, where interest rates were in 1980 when Volcker was raising interest rates, he was able to do that, Chris, because debt to GDP was only 25%. Today, debt to GDP is about 130%. So there's no way that you can do that with rising interest rates. We would simply collapse if we did that. So they're going to use yield curve control, financial repression, and keep interest rates artificially low. At the same time, they're going to run up inflation. It's the only choice left. If the government was to run 10 to 15% inflation, which is probably the real inflation rate that we're experiencing now, I mean, does anybody really believe we're at a 5% inflation rate? Just go to the grocery store, look at your utilities. Nationally, utilities have gone up about 25% over the last 2 years. Look at gasoline, look at your insurance premiums. I don't care. Anything that you need, the basic necessities of life are going up at almost double digits. So if they can inflate their way out, keep interest rates suppressed, which is what we did after World War II to get our debt levels down as GDP grew, that is a way out of this. Because let's face it, they're not going to cut entitlements, but I do see, Chris, they're probably going to restrict them. Just as like in 1984, when we got Social Security reform for the first time, prior to 1984, when you got a Social Security check, it was tax-free. It was getting your money back. You didn't pay taxes. With Social Security reform in 1984, they started taxing 50% of Social Security benefits. And then under Bill Clinton in 1994, they raised the taxation of Social Security benefits to 85%, and they haven't raised the limit on which that percentage kicks in. So they're more likely to do something like that. There's going to be a push. This is going on in France right now, where Macron wants to raise the retirement age by 2 years. I see that coming. And we did that. We raised it from 65. It's now going to 67. I could see them raising that to 69. And you've sort of got a hint of this by they're raising the year that you have to begin mandatory distribution from your pension plans. It used to be 70 and a half. It was raised to 72. This year, it's 73. And I think in 2 years from now, it'll be 75. So that gives you a hint where you're going to go. And people are going to have to work longer, which they're doing anyway, just to keep even with this inflation. So that's coming. So they're not going to be reducing these benefits. They'll probably tax more of them. They'll probably limit them for upper income Americans. And they're not going to cut the military spending. I mean, we're sending over $100 billion a year or more to the Ukraine, and there is no accountability of how that money's being spent. And I could see, and there's already some trial balloons put out there, but they're talking about maybe a national sales tax, like a VAT tax that they have in Europe and Canada. So in addition to the sales tax you pay locally, they might start out at 5, 6, 7% sales tax, a national sales tax, to bring in more revenue. So that's coming, which, by the way, is going to be highly inflationary. If you raise income taxes too much, then you actually get less of it. And remember, when President Trump cut taxes, you know, they had record tax revenues. But at the same time, we've had record spending. Spending is gone up three times what the tax revenues have, which is one of the reasons we have these massive deficits.
Now, all of this isn't a problem as long as the Fed is monetizing the debt by buying U.S. treasuries, or if foreigners are willing to continue buying U.S. debt, you know, IOUs from the U.S. government. But what are we seeing underway right now?
Well, here's the problem that the Treasury is running into.
and that is financing the U.S. debt. It wasn't a problem when it was a smaller amount. Our deficits were manageable. But something occurred early on in the last decade. It was right around 2014, 2015. Foreigners stopped financing our deficit. And you saw the consequences of this last year. As the dollar rose, foreigners dumped $1 trillion of U.S. treasuries to prop up their own currencies. And the result of that was probably the worst bond market we've seen in over 40 years, with treasuries losing more than actually the S&P 500. And that's one of the issues. So in 2014 and 15, they changed the regulations that made it more favorable for banks to own treasuries because they were considered safe and liquid. And they also did the same with money market funds. And so since 2014, one of the biggest purchasers of U.S. debt has been the banking system. And we'll get to that in a second, because that is one of the problems, and also money market funds. So, Chris, this was working until we went on the spending orgy that we've been on since COVID, and especially the last 2 years under the Biden administration. The debt and the spending was just too large. And so banks and money market funds were accumulating treasuries. Well, this all worked fine as long as inflation was moderate. But that wasn't fine. And last year, the Fed went from inflation was temporary to, uh-oh, we've got a problem here. And we saw one of the fastest rate raising cycles in U.S. history, where we took the Fed funds rate from almost zero to almost 5% by the end of the year. And it looks like in May, they'll probably raise it another quarter of a point, raising it to 5.25%. Well, what did that do to those bond portfolios? If you were a bank and you were buying 10-year, 20-year treasuries, they were paying 0.5%, 1%. Think of the losses. I think the figure in bank portfolios was about $650 billion of losses in bond portfolios. Secondly, it triggered a bank run. I mean, most consumers, banks just aren't paying that much in interest because they're not really loaning a lot of money. And so you had these bank runs like Silicon Valley or First Republic. I'm surprised, probably, you know, look at this weekend, it could probably be taken over by the government. And so as money pours out of the banking system, as people exit it for safety reasons and plus, let's say, lack of yield, that's creating a crisis for banks, which is forcing them to sell more treasuries. So what the Fed did is they came up with a swap program. So basically, if you had a $1,000 bond that was worth maybe 70 cents on the dollar, you could swap it to the Fed and get a dollar back for 1 year. It's kind of a swap. The question is, what's going to happen 1 year from now when those swaps come due? And what if interest rates aren't down? Personally, I think the Fed's going to end up cutting. They're going to have to, because if they keep raising it, they are going to collapse the financial markets and the economy. But what it does, as the Fed raises interest rates, it strengthens the dollar. Because I'm just looking right now at my Bloomberg screen. We've got six-month treasuries at 5%, one-year treasuries at 4.8%, three-month treasury bills are 5%. Now, bear in mind, you know, a little over a year ago, you were lucky if you got one-tenth of 1% on a three-month T-bill. Today, you're getting over 5%. So that just gives you the magnitude of what these Fed rate hikes have done to the treasury market and what it's done to bond portfolios. It basically devastated them last year. And we saw these huge, huge losses. And as the dollar got stronger, making matters worse, foreign central banks started dumping treasuries. So you have that going on. You have another thing that's going on. The U.S. has used the payment system in our currency to freeze assets like Russia. So you have a lot of emerging market countries that are commodity producers that are joining up with OPEC, Russia, and China, and they're moving out of the dollar. They're settling payments for oil and gold or other currencies. So that is also putting pressure on the markets. So all of this is taking place, and all these options, Chris, are inflationary.
Jim, earlier you had mentioned how we saw, you know, a pretty big crash in the bond market, and that
that the losses were commensurate with what we've seen in the stock market. I mean, that's not supposed to happen. You're supposed to see less volatility in your bond portfolio as a hedge. And of course, this relates to the 60-40 stock bond portfolio. But as we've been discussing, I mean, there's some problems with that. And, you know, you've recommended alternatives to your traditional 60-40 portfolio. So how does this relate to how investors should be approaching diversification in their portfolios?
Well, one thing, Chris, I would not be in long-term bonds. If you're going to be in bonds, keep them short-term. I mean, we're in corporates 2 years or less, and we are in treasury bills anywhere from 3-6 months to 2 years. You want to keep it short and rolled over because you're highly liquid, because you just don't want to get involved if, let's say, if the dollar strengthens, it's going to create another funding crisis and a bond market crisis, because they're going to be dumping treasuries. And that's the big risk out there that the Fed is facing. And the other thing, too, that we're facing is the Fed raises interest rates, it's going to cause a recession, which means what happens in a recession? Less tax revenues. What happens in a recession? The government ends up spending more money on welfare entitlements. Third thing that happens, more interest cost with more debt. So, Chris, there is just simply no way out of this but to inflate. And so that's why, with inflation on the horizon, they're not going to get down to 2%. There's no way that's going to happen, especially with what's going on in the energy markets, what's going on with fiscal spending. I mean, they're talking about a fiscal debt ceiling crisis. It's always a major crisis, and they end up settling at the last minute. But the Biden budget is going to create more spending, which is going to create larger deficits. I think the CBO said it would add about another $19 trillion of debt. So by the end of his first term, we could be at $40 trillion in debt, and we could be at maybe close to $50 trillion or more by the end of the decade. It is just simply too big.
Yeah, and the problem that the banks are experiencing, I mean, all this ties together because, as you noted, you know, we're seeing deposits fly out of these banks. And many of these banks, Silicon Valley Bank, Signature Bank, and now we see, you know, First Republic Bank down 50% at one point today. Obviously, this banking crisis and the turmoil that we've seen there is not quite over yet, as we've been saying on the show. But, you know, these banks are having to sell out of those long-term bonds, which they really ramped up on when deposits were flowing in. And so now they're seeing losses. They're being forced to sell. And so this is putting pressure on their balance sheet, but also leading to wider problems as well. So all these things are connected. And you know, you mentioned earlier that you do think we're going to see a funding crisis ahead. Is this really in relation to the debt ceiling that we're facing later this year, or how do you assess this?
You mentioned that we were talking about First Republic. I'm just looking at the chart. I mean, take a look at this. You're going to see more of this with some of these regional banks. This is a stock that was at 171 in August of last year. This morning is at $3.87. So, I mean, it's basically lost over 90% of its value here in, what, 6 months? So we're going to see more of this. Here's what we see coming. I mean, the deficit this year, it's approaching $3 trillion. We're already over $1 trillion, which is about 7 to 8% of GDP. If you take a look at recessions, usually in a recession, tax revenues fall, government spending goes up. In recessions, by the time you get to the trough of a recession, the deficits go up by 6 to 12%. So if we're already at 7 to 8%, let's just be conservative and take 6% and add that on that, you're talking about 13 to 15% of a deficit in relation to GDP. That is going to create a funding for the Treasury anywhere, Chris, from $3 to $5 trillion. And then the other additional thing that you have, remember, the Fed is implementing QT. As their bonds mature, they're not rolling them over and buying new bonds. They're just allowing them to vaporize and disappear. I mean, we created those bonds out of money out of thin air, and they're disappearing out of thin air. So the Treasury is not rolling over about $1 trillion, which I think they're going to have to stop doing that. And then also, as the Fed raises interest rates, it could strengthen the dollar, which would force foreigners to sell treasuries again, which could create another bond market debacle. So these are some of the things that we're looking at. Not only that, as money is pulled out of banks, which is what you're seeing with First Republic right now, they've had massive, massive deposit withdrawals. As that happens, it forces these banks to sell their treasuries. And so you could see additional treasury selling coming in from banks as they try to liquidate, cover their loan losses. And you're going to see a lot of losses coming in regional banks, especially in the commercial real estate market. So banks are forced to sell treasuries for losses and deposit withdrawals. So once again, the treasury could be facing and having to issue and raise $3 to $5 trillion of new debt. And as I pointed out, whatever they settle on the Biden budget is probably going to add another $19 trillion of debt by 2030. So what is coming, Chris? The only way they're going to have to do this, and they've already started it, the swapping of bank bonds to the Fed is the first attempt at yield curve control. It's already started. So all of this is going to be highly inflationary. Add rising energy prices due to geology and depletion, lack of investment, and bad government policies. All of this points to a double-digit inflation decade.
Now, when it comes to this funding crisis ahead that you just spoke about, do you think that the looming debt ceiling battle is going to be the thing that sort of kickstarts that process? I'm just wondering, in terms of timing, do you think that this is more of a near-term concern or something that we should expect to take place, you know, over the 2-3 or multi-year time horizon?
Oh, I think this is near-term. I don't think they're going to wait to August. This is going to be something that's going to impact the market, unless they do a Hail Mary and at the last minute come to some kind of solution. But whatever solution they're going to come to, it's going to involve more government spending. We're going to have more inflation. And the Fed is really caught in a no-win situation. If they keep raising interest rates to curb inflation, how are you going to do that when fiscal policy is at odds with monetary policy? The Fed's trying to control inflation by cutting back with QT, raising rates, while Congress and the administration is raising spending, pushing money into the economy. Because when money's created, it can do one of three things. You can keep it, hold it, put it in a mattress, doesn't do anything. Secondly, you can spend it, put it in the economy, which could be inflationary. Or third, you can put it in the financial markets. So for two decades, most of that inflation took place in the financial markets. But beginning with COVID, the lockdowns in the Biden administration, now that money is being pushed into the economy, and that is highly inflationary. So the two policies are at odds with each other. And in the end, this is going to be a fiscal policy control because, like I said, they're not going to cut spending on the military. They're not going to cut entitlements. And so what are they going to do? They're going to have to go to yield curve control, and they're going to have to start inflating this budget. All of that means that you need to reposition yourself if you're an investor for an inflationary decade.
So, Jim, on the day that you and I are speaking, it's Friday, April 28th. The S&P 500 right now is at 4127. So it's been firming in the face of consistent signs that we're moving ever so slowly towards a recession. As we've been saying on the show, you know, we think that that's probably going to line up in the second half. Anna Wong, chief U.S. economist at Bloomberg, who we just spoke with recently and will air that interview next week on FS Insider, saying that they bumped up the timetable for a U.S. recession a few months, given the deterioration that we're seeing in the data. Stock market doesn't seem to care much about this or be too worried about a recession. So what is your view and what are some of the investment implications given what we discussed today?
Well, number one, what really surprised me, we follow money flows. And in the first quarter, we almost had a record amount of money of dollars flowing into passive index funds. And so it's mainly individual investors. And it's kind of like they don't see the cliff that they're running up against. But the investment implications, Chris, I think passive indexing is dead. You're going to experience big losses if that's the way you position yourself. I also think the 60-40 does not work in an inflationary environment. You know, it reminds me when I got into this business in 1980, We were just coming out of the Volcker rate hikes. Inflation hit 14%. And I remember one of the first financial plans I was working on back then. It was a gentleman. He was a retired CEO of a major Fortune 500 company. When he retired in the late 60s, you know, he did what most people did. You put your money in fixed income. He was in municipal bonds, some corporates, and some treasuries. And I remember almost a $750,000 bond portfolio. When he came into our office, it was only worth about $400,000. He had literally lost almost half of his money in his bond portfolio because he was buying bonds at 2, 3, 4%. And here we were dealing with interest rates on treasuries at 15.5%. Munis were at 9 and 10%. Corporates are at double digits. You were getting 12 to 14%, 15% on corporates. It devastated him. And that's the kind of era that we're entering into. So you're going to need a different strategy if you want to survive financially. You need to have, as we have said, and many of our guests on the program, you need to have a base of precious metals. Now, we're working on a solution on that because Eagles right now are too expensive. You pay anywhere from 60 to 80% premiums by the dealers, and we're hoping to fix that. You need to own commodities and hard assets, things like oil, copper, gold, silver, and base metals, especially the base metals that are used in the green transition, everything from copper to nickel. And if you watch our Monday morning investment briefs and videos, we touched upon that and just showed how low. I mean, we could be running out of copper by the end of the year. So we like that. The other thing that I think you're going to see, and this is a thesis of mine, as inflation takes hold, the poor and the middle class are going to get hit the hardest. And what that means is they're going to have less and less money for discretionary spending. So, you know, the areas that we own outside of commodities are things like drug, medical companies, and staples, things that people have to live, that and utilities, because there just isn't simply going to be that much money left. I mean, just take a look at California. I mean, we're doing insane things here. They're going to up regulations on railroads that are going to make it more expensive for a railroad to come into the state. That's going to be passed on through higher freight charges. They're talking about repricing utilities in the state based on your income. You could see something like that at the national level. And we do like cash, but we're mainly in short-term bonds, corporate bonds, 2 years or less, in treasuries. And like I pointed out, right now, especially in our corporate cash accounts, we've been using everything from treasuries to short-term corporates to get 5, 6, 6.5%. And that's where you want to keep your money short-term. You don't want to put everything in stocks. You want to have some liquid cash because I do think a downturn's coming. But, you know, as hard as this may sound, we will get through this. This isn't the first time countries have faced inflation, whether it's England, Argentina, Israel, Turkey. Many of these countries have gone through this. We'll get through this as well. But it's going to be a rough going this decade. As we talked about, three major crises: energy, the national debt, and the dollar. But you need to position yourself because this isn't going to be like the 00 decade or the last decade where you just put your money in passive index funds. And remember, folks, as hard as this may sound, in March of 2000, the S&P hit a peak. It fell 55% over the next 2 years, then would spend the next 5 years up to 2007 in September of that year, getting back to where it was in March of 2000. Then it fell 60%. So if you were in a passive index fund in 2000, it wouldn't be till March and April of 2013 when you broke even. So you need to change your investment strategy to survive. And the time to do that is now.
Yeah. And one of the things that we've been discussing now here for at least 2 to 3 years is the likelihood of seeing a 1966 to 1982 type situation or scenario with the markets long term for this decade, where we trade in a very volatile sideways fashion. And that was something that we also discussed in the first hour with the technician, Ron William, who said that his cycle work, his long term cycle work, is also pointing in that direction. So there's a number of things you can do. And obviously, being a little bit more active is probably going to be the way to go, because it's not just going to be multi-year bull or multi-year bear markets. Very likely, as we saw in that 1966 and 1982 time period, and as we've seen in other secular bear markets, you need to be nimble and you need to play it correctly. So that is what we are doing here at Financial Sense Wealth Management. Again, if you'd like to give any of us a call or contact us to speak with any of our investment advisors, leave us a message on our website, financialsense.com, where it says contact us, or you can always give us a call at 888-486-3939.
In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Sheridan and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until we all talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.